and we should be going live. So, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is John Johnson from Radio Edutalk. I'm sitting in Glasgow in Scotland, and I'm not joined tonight by David Noble from Fife because, well, his team is in an important football match tonight, and that came first. This show was put together at rather short notice. One of the things I've been playing with recently is the Teach the Web MOOC, which has been run by the Mozilla Foundation. Now, this morning, somebody suggested that Radio Edutalk was a good thing to share on the Teach Web because we're talking about open, and of course Edutalk is an open to anybody podcast, and I thought that was great, but I thought it would be interesting to pull somebody in from the Teach the Web community. And although it's really short notice and time zones are rubbish, we've got a couple of people from Mozilla actually coming to talk to us tonight. And first up we've got Chris Lawrence, and I'll ask him to introduce himself in a wee while, and Chris is going to do a wee while with us, and then we'll switch into Laura Hilliger. I think I've pronounced that name right. Chris, could you maybe just introduce yourself? I believe you're in, are you in New York at the moment? Tell us a wee bit about your background and stuff, and then we'll take it from there.
Tandem of the Hive Learning Network in New York City. And just to give you a real brief background on that. So the Hive Learning Network is a network of out-of-school time learning providers. So museums, libraries, after-school clubs, coding clubs, youth media clubs, things of that nature that have come together with a grant from the MacArthur Foundation to think about what does a networked approach an open ethos and collaboration amongst these kind of providers look like to help solve the problem of what is a learning ecosystem in a large urban center that is sort of more than school and in support of school. And about 2 years ago, Mozilla took over actually the stewardship of the Hive Learning Network in New York City, which I was the director of. And then within sort of existing in the Mozilla Foundation's learning efforts, we wanted to do more direct outreach to educators, parents, to mentors of all stripes around web making and even making more writ large. And the Hive Learning Network then becomes a big piece of that, a big sort of strategy towards how you build strong local networks in places and then link those networks. The Hives currently exist in Chicago and Pittsburgh, New York City, Toronto, Athens, Greece. There's some momentum towards one in London and the Bay Area here in the United States. So kind of where that work of Hive and the mentor community stop and start is kind of a permeable boundary. But as part of this work and how we kind of level up and activate mentors around the idea of Teach the Web and the web as an open platform and a sort of making spirit as a, you know, participatory culture and participatory education, we thought we'd kind of jump into the MOOC movement a little bit. We admit we're a little bit Johnny come lately to that, but we thought it would be really an excellent way to talk about not only our tools and our philosophies, but to level up and activate mentors and people who are connected to this work. And so that's what we've done with this MOOC, and we think we've taken some interesting approaches and really linked this more to the sort of connectivist version of MOOCs and the sort of more sort of distributed networked approach than the more sort of university or sort of top-down approaches that others have taken. So, and so far, the first couple of weeks, we've been really excited by the activity and energy around the initiative.
Yeah. I'm certainly glad myself that you've gone for the CMOOC model. I don't really know much about the XMOOCs, but I came through DS106 and then into the ETMOOC for a while, and that seems to be the model you're following. And You mentioned openness and the sort of task this week, I suppose, for people on the ET MOOC is to talk about open collaboration and how they work together and to actually practically work together. And you seem really, really open to all sorts of activities coming into the MOOC.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a belief, at least in, so the open web, right, and Mozilla is obviously seen as, you know, a leader in the open source software movement, and, you know, the fire with, you know, sort of the Firefox is the best example, and you know, and then they sort of, you know, to not to be too small about it, sort of change the world with the with Firefox as a browser and protecting open standards and really helping an open source software movement take a couple of giant steps forward. So, and but what we sort of have, especially as the foundation has gotten more into the learning space and how that open ethos and a kind of open source operating system translates into many different professions and walks of life, you know, whether that's civic engagement and education and learning, which is a lot of where our work is, but we also within the foundation have work with the Knight Foundation around open news. So how does kind of an open source culture and coding and development work inside newsrooms, for instance? So how do we actually, you know, kind of take an open culture approach and the lessons and that learn from the software movement and put those into other sectors? So and that's something that in the foundation side we're super excited about. And by doing that, you have to acknowledge that you're not just interested in your own stuff, right? That you have to create that big tent that many people, tools, philosophies, people feel comfortable existing in that open space. And so I think we're about to, on June 15th, start a global campaign called Maker Party 2013, which is kind of I call it the offspring of our campaign last year, which was the Summer Code Party. And what we learned, interestingly enough, through the Summer Code Party was that people around the globe, 700 events, you know, thousands of people, they love to rally around the Mozilla idea, to this open software and open culture. They liked the idea that they were connecting to something larger, but by doing things that they already were doing. You know, and so we called it Summer Code Party, but people were doing much more stuff than code. They were using it to come together to do physical computing or to do art or to do, you know, to build robots or to build, you know, mobile apps. And we really loved that happened. And we were, so this year we kind of wanted to a little bit drink our Kool-Aid. And so how do we kind of, of course, we care about WebMaker and the WebMaker tools, and we think they're dynamic tools, but you have to, if you want to play in that big tent, you have to acknowledge that people, when you build a movement, are going to want to come with stuff they care about and see where those recombination of things they care about, that you care about, and new spaces for things that we collectively care about to emerge. So that's really kind of been our emergent philosophy, and it's really been kind of interesting to, in some ways, as we take this open ethos into different sectors, to kind of see how that makes us think about how we act and interact with others and kind of stay constantly reflective about that.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a fantastic movement. I mean, I've just browsed the odd page and read a few blog reports about the different open activities and hack fests and things that you've done, but they just look great fun, really vibrant places. And you're saying to move into other sectors. The sector I'm in is education, and I've seen lots of this is at a distance rather than at first hand, but lots of examples of good out of school learning or weekends where people can come along. And I wonder, is there a way to sort of get that inside formal education, or is that something you think is not necessary? It could be just a space for people to learn outside formal education.
Yeah, that's the £1 million question, so to speak, right? So in the work in the Hive Network, we sort of started and launched the initiative about 5 years ago with a real kind of you know, just to be kind of crass about it, you know, we don't care about schools. We're going to build up this sort of ecosystem of informal learning and free choice learning. And a lot of my personal background in it and training and education has been, you know, how do you educate and build up in informal spaces? And, you know, that's somewhat safe, and it's not easy to do, but you can kind of build really dynamic laboratories and all kinds of projects. But I think what we quickly realized, as well as the larger MacArthur Digital Media and Learning Initiative, realized that is if you don't, you know, that you're always going to hit a ceiling if you're not including formal education, schools, individual teachers, and systems into that conversation. And so I think we've really evolved in that we have to acknowledge that in a learner's life, you know, especially with young learners, that school is not the end-all and be-all of their educational journey, and that a larger ecosystem and places for that learning to be pushed forward, to be examined, is essential. So we didn't stop believing that, but we also had to realize that we had to make, you know, what are the bridges and the inroads in with formal, and so that we could grow together and think about, you know, how does school kind of be, yes, a very large node or even a hub within an ecosystem of learning, mm-hmm. But is part of that same ecosystem. And so over the last couple of years, we've started to shift some of our philosophy, and we've started, at least in the New York City context, make a lot of inroads and doing programs with, whether it's individual teachers or anything as big as the New York City Department of Education. But and what I think has been great about Teach the Web and some of Mozilla's webmaker initiatives and our mentor community is that we very much want to work with, right, in a sort of open source context. We want to see what teachers can teach us. You know, what can they tell us? How can they use the tools, build the tools, build the lessons and curriculum, build the pathways? You know, so our model is if we can empower them, they'll tell us, you know, what is how they're integrated and how new models can emerge.
Yeah, hopefully they will. The thing is, I mean, I think personally I'm very interested in this, and I see some teachers around the place who are really interested and excited about these ideas, but to move it forward, it's got to be something, I think, in education, if it's going to spread right through, it's got to come top down to some extent, and in our culture at the moment, it's got to be linked in at some point with the exam system, and I think that's one switch that could turn things on really well, and certainly in Scotland, and I suspect in England, I don't know, and about the US, I could see, as I'm a, well, not now, but I was a primary school teacher, and it would be reasonably easy for me to add a wee bit of web making secret sauce into any kind of lesson. But once kids get to high school, and especially later on in high school, they're very focused here on exams, and it would need to come from that would need to drive it, I think, into the classroom, and I wondered, were you working at all with the government level with anybody, or talking to anybody there?
Not, well, I mean, I think in, you know, especially in the United States, but in other places, you know, where you have these large systems, we sort of take what's a local approach. So, you know, New York City and Chicago and Pittsburgh, the hives there and the broader mentor stuff is working with the local governments there, and how this integrates. In fact, Mozilla has been really, you know, in England also talking at that same sort of level. You know, I think the Next Generation report, if I'm getting that right, you know, taking some inspiration from that. And I think, you know, the highlighting of web and digital literacies as core skills. And so I think one of our plays there, because you have to acknowledge that these things have to be core skills, or it has to be, you know, something essential that every kid should learn as the, you know, from the policy standpoint. But I don't think it's that hard a case to make that this kind of web or digital literacy, you know, is an essential skill as we continue to progress in this century, and that kids and youth that aren't primed to kind of understand, even if it doesn't progress much past an understanding and an awareness of how these things work, are going to be at a fairly serious disadvantage. And so within Mozilla, you know, some of the work led by Doug Belshaw and Carla Casilli around the web literacy standards is like, how do we actually, you know, we just spent some time really bearing down and looking at what those are and how you might start to codify those so that we don't always just say, hey, this is important, or, you know, web literacy is important, or you should get digital literacy into curriculum or into testing, but actually come forth with, you know, it may even be a straw man to a degree, but that at least is a gets us a lot further down the conversation, and people can start to see how you might operationalize that as something that is tested for or baked into the curriculum. You know, it's sort of like, you know, don't we wish we all knew how our cars worked, so to speak. You know, I think there's some real practical reasons and ways that you can spin that, that even from a civics point of view, like understanding how the digital world works is fairly huge.
Yeah, as you're speaking, it's chiming with me, because part of the more recent changes in curriculum in Scotland, we've gone on to this curriculum for excellence, and part of that makes literacy across learning the responsibility of all teachers. And if you look into the literacy spec, for want of a better word, it's talking about texts as in not just books, but texts as in text messages, texts as in web pages and things like this. So maybe that's the, is instead of thinking this is a computer science initiative, is to actually think, well, no, it's a literacy initiative, and being able to speak as well as read the web is really important.
Yeah, and you know, Mark Sermon, our executive director in Mozilla, you know, the sort of the read, write, web, right? So, you know, like, I think it is a really important message. And, you know, so it's not just consumption, it's also production. You know, you don't, you know, literacy doesn't mean just being able to read text. It means being able to write text, too. And I think there's a lot of great, you know, analogies there. And then in a lot of our work this summer with the campaign and the Maker Party work, we're partnering with the National Writing Project here in the U.S., and they, you know, they get that sort of what is a read-write culture really at their core from a literacy standpoint, from the importance of knowing how to read and write, and have been, I think, visionaries and pioneers in how you actually spin that forward into new texts. So I agree with you, John, that like if it, that might be the narrative thread that can tie some of this up into the sort of educational systems. And that starts, you know, I think that starts to have a lot of resonance with people. You know, sometimes we talk about the three R's or whatever, but what, you know, is a fourth R, relevancy. And, you know, and understanding these varied texts is hyper relevant today.
Brilliant. I don't know how you're doing for time, Chris, but I'm going to pull in Laura at the moment now, so we'll hear some ringing and bring her into the conversation. And certainly if you're moving on somewhere, feel free to head off or drop out wherever you are. And if you do have to go, I'd just like to say a huge thank you for what you've given us so far. Laura,
no problem.
Are you here, Laura?
Yes.
Hi, this is Hi. John Johnson. I'm just saying to Chris, I don't know if you were listening, but I think he's given us a rather wonderful overview of the Mozilla Teach the Web project. And hopefully maybe with yourself we can hone in a wee bit more.
Sorry,
on the MOOC. Are you okay? Can you hear us okay? I can certainly hear you at least typing, Laura. I don't know if...
You know what, John? I've got to drop off anyway, so maybe
okay.
I'll drop off, might clean up the signal.
Can I just say thanks very much again, Chris? I know you had zero time and a really short notice. Hopefully this will be just another valuable resource to be included in all the ones you've been putting out about helping spread the work you're doing. Thank you.
No, John. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm actually off to a meeting of Hive New York, so sort of relevant there. And I'm sure you'll get Laura on the line here, and she'll continue the conversation. And thanks. I look forward to hearing it all in its entirety.
All right. Okay. Thanks very much, Chris. We'll see you later. Laura seems to be having a wee bit of trouble understanding us, so I think I'll probably hang up on her. I'll stay on the line and then phone call her again. Does that make sense, Laura? I'm just going to hang up right now. So I'm just going to hang up and call Laura again.
Is that better?
I can hear you really well. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. I'm not sure if we're in real time or not.
Real time-ish. as real as any other time is, I suppose.
I still hear you in double.
In double?
Let's see. Okay, there we go. I just needed to close one of my browser windows, apparently.
Right, okay.
Hi there.
Hi. So we're live on the air on Radio Edutalk. If folk do want to, just remind them, if they want to, they're listening live and they want to ask us a question, if they either tweet at myself or probably Laura or with the hashtag Edutalk, EDUTALK, we'll pick it up and try and answer things. This will be archived and will be put up out as a podcast quite soon. So, Laura, really thanks very much for first putting me in touch with Chris at really short notice and two popping along to have a wee talk. Hopefully you've heard what went on earlier. I think Chris, as I say, covered the sort of background information about Mozilla. And I could have listened to him for a lot longer. But maybe after one or two questions about that, we could move on to the MOOC and talk about how it's going.
Sure.
But could you maybe start off by telling us who you are and where you are?
Sure. I'm currently calling in from Toronto, Canada, but I live in Germany. I actually arrived here yesterday. I work on the WebMaker Mentor team along with Chris, and I actually do a lot of work sort of bridging the gap between education and technology. So traditionally, Mozilla is seen as a technology company, but with the WebMaker initiative, we're really jumping into the educational space, which Chris talked a little bit about, and talking about digital literacy and empowering people to, well, I'll just repeat the tagline, to produce things instead of just consume things on the web. So I'm very excited about what's been going on in Teach the Web, which we are calling a MOOC, but we were kind of changing the acronym for that and calling it a Mozilla Open Online Collaboration.
Good branding. I've been enjoying very much the MOOC, whether it's a Mozilla or a Massive, I don't know. it seems to be, to me, quite light-spirited. You're actually producing it and producing the program as you go, which I think is quite nice and sort of mirrors to some extent the way software is built, building something and iterating it, and also mirrors, I think, how some of the things have been going on inside it. You're following, I think, the sort of ET MOOC theme. Yeah, and it's just, I wonder how you feel first about maybe generally how it's going, how the tools are going, the sort of response you're getting.
Yeah, so last year when Alec Carsoz put out a call for collaboration on the ET MOOC, I had jumped in and I did a lot of behind-the-scenes work because I'm a fan of Alec's, and I sort of wanted to see what he was thinking this educational technology MOOC would be, and just kind of get an idea of how the community would build a course like that. And so I sort of looked at it from two angles. From, on the one hand, I wanted to learn about connectivist MOOCs. EdMOOC was sort of my first experience in that space. And on the other hand, I wanted to learn whether or not something like that would be interesting for the Mozilla community. And after going through all of ET MOOC, I sort of, you know, we sort of took a look at it and said, yes, you know, the Mozilla community would be interested in this. And this is a really good way to get both people from the technology side interacting with people from the education side, and to sort of just remove the barriers for people. And so with Teach the Web, you're absolutely right. It's completely open, and we are, everything that we're creating is actually created by learners. So on the website, there's a planning tab where people can go and see how we're actually planning the course. And it's, so basically it's an experience that is what you make of it. And you know, there's no deadlines or requirements. It's really about getting people to start having a conversation, no matter which perspective they're coming from. And that conversation centers around this idea that, you know, we all need to level up in our skills around the web, and not just technical skills, but social skills, cultural skills. And I think that it's been going really well. We have a very active community. People are really having fun making things and sharing things. And, you know, people are really jumping into not only the WebMaker tools, but other tool sets as well, and just sort of exploring what it means to be creative on the web. And we've seen some awesome stuff coming out of it, and I couldn't be happier with how it's going.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to give you an opportunity to join in at whatever sort of level you are. There's obviously some people who are quite deep thinkers and are blogging in detail, and there's other people who are just playing, testing out the tools and having a good time. I'm sure the deep thinkers are having a good time thinking deeply, but for some of the rest of us, we're just, it seems to be generating a very sort of playful space, which is quite interesting to contrast maybe to more formal education.
I think that for, you know, as an adult looking back at my own educational path, I think that one of the problems with education is, you know, that we kind of look at it as this serious endeavor. But when we play and when we interact with each other at a level that is light-spirited and fun, we learn so much. So, you know, why shouldn't learning be fun? Why shouldn't it be lighthearted when it's such a good way to engage people? I think that play is something that should absolutely be worked back into formal education spaces as well as informal spaces, and in our learning as in general. It's something that human beings have always done, and when we look at education as such a serious endeavor, you know, people get turned off by that. And, you know, I think that having that element of play is part of the reason that Teach the Web is going so well. You know, if we had a bunch of, you know, you have to do this, and this is like, you know, this is the syllabus, and we're not changing it, and no, you can't participate in your own learning and just do it this way. I think that we wouldn't have such an active community of people who are really taking risks. You know, one of the things that we always say in open source, like in the open community and in the open source community, is that you learn a lot more from failure than you do from success. And I think that sort of remains true, but it's, you know, when we think of failure, we think of a negative connotation, and I don't think that it has to be that way. I think that, you know, if we can encourage people to fail a little bit and to be okay with their failure and to like look at the ways that they fail, it's more beneficial for their learning than, you know, trying to be perfect.
I think that there's a wee bit of a debate over here going on about failure, because it's become a sort of almost a mantra among some educationalists, that, you know, this idea that we should be bringing failure in, and, you know, failing early, failing often and things. And I was quite interested in one of the games-based learning people in Scotland, Derek Robertson, who said, you know, when he watches children play games, and he's very interested in using electronic and non-electronic games for education, is that the children don't really seem to be feeling that they're failing. You know, it's not the sort of vocabulary they use, which gave me a start, because I've always thought, yeah, that I do learn by making mistakes. He seemed to be suggesting that kids who are learning maybe in Minecraft or Premier League Manager 73 or whatever, one of these Xbox games, that the children were learning without really feeling the failure.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how that fits.
Oh, I was just going to say, I recently heard an anecdote about the difference between Eastern formal education systems and Western formal education systems. And somebody said, that in China and Japan, if a kid walks up to a blackboard and solves the problem right away, everybody remains quiet. But if they go up and make a mistake, then people cheer. and it's sort of this idea of, you know, like, instead of saying that something is a failure, maybe we should just call it a prototype, you know, or the first iteration, or, you know, find a way to encourage people to experiment and, again, play.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, you know, figure out what is the best course of action, because nobody knows the best course of action the first time, like, for anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you always do things several times before you realize that that's the way you should have done it the first time. And that's what learning is all about, you know, taking risks and experimenting and you know, finding a better way to do things, or a better way to understand things, or a better way to, you know, talk to people about things. So
one of the things that you've done to sort of enable this this playing is that there's a series of tools. I mean, I'm not sure exactly how you, the ones I've seen in the MOOC and some of the webmaker stuff are around the Hackasaurus, Thimble, and Popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly you seem to be improving those all the time. I mean, I had a look at Popcorn about a year or so ago, I think,
mm-hmm.
maybe longer, and at that point I just gave up because it beach balled my machine, and it just didn't seem to be. You could see the potential, but I couldn't see it working. And
mm-hmm.
revisiting it for the course, I've been really impressed about the way that it's come on, that it becomes it's a much more fluid tool.
Mm-hmm. I remember the first iteration too. The UI was awful.
Yeah. I mean, I think at that point there was a JavaScript library, and it was actually easier to use that and figure out what to type rather than use the UI. But the way that you've improved things and the way you're working this MOOC, and almost the way that you're inviting people to learn, is there a deliberate mirroring of the way open source software works?
Well, definitely. All of our tools are open source, and so they're developed in an open community. And they, you know, we release early and we release often. We go and play with our tools with other people and see what they think and see what they say. And then we go back and make them better. And, you know, all of this happens in the open. So whatever anyone thinks about, you know, basically anything that Mozilla is doing, everybody has a voice and can share their thoughts. And it's, you know, we're a bunch of friendly humans that really take into consideration what people are thinking. And so with the tools, you know, we like to make things and then see whether or not people like them. And if people don't like them, then at some point, you know, they'll kind of fall away. But for the X-ray goggles, Thimble, and Popcorn, you know, we've just kept having people say to us, these are really awesome tools. I can imagine doing a lot of things with these. And we've been trying to make it easier and easier. And actually, for this, the Maker Party 2013 that Chris was talking about, we're doing a ton of upgrades and improvements to webmaker.org. So we're creating things like single sign-on so that you can, you know, sign on and save your work from any of the tools. Right now you can only save your work in mm-hmm. Popcorn, and like with Thimble, you edit a page and you get a new URL every time you publish. So we're working on improving the way that a user can move through the different tools, but also trying to create ways for both learners and mentors to keep track of their learning paths. Finding ways that they can, you know, do peer assessment with each other, just tons of little improvements that will make it easier for people to make and share what they've made on the web.
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching as the course goes on. People have been posting, like, for instance, just before we came on, I saw somebody posting to the G Plus community that they've now got an RSS feed for the Blog Hub, for instance. And it's very interesting to see sort of a course, and even the teaching methods adapt as you go.
Mm-hmm.
One of my paid job is a staff tutor for North Lanarkshire Council in Scotland for ICT. And one of the things that is difficult, I think, is to get people to use things, or teachers who are not all that comfortable with ICT, is to get them used to things that don't work. They don't mm-hmm. like things that, you know, will fall over in the middle of a lesson. And I think, I mean, some teachers are quite happy to do that. People, teachers are ICT literate, will use a tool, and if it doesn't work, they'll pivot and do something else. But for some of our other staff who maybe don't have the same skills, they get quite uptight about this. And I'm thinking, you know, how do you get these sort of tools into the classroom? And do you think they're actually ready for non-technical people to take children into yet?
Yeah, so I mean, that's something that we're trying to work on through initiatives like Teach the Web, and through, you know, work that we do on the ground with a variety of different organizations, where, you know, Mozilla has, you know, we really do want educators as well to sort of level up their skills and to sort of get to a place with their own, you know, use of technology where they understand that things don't always work, mm-hmm. and find a way to be sort of nimble about their approach to teaching when using technical tools. And we're, you know, it's really a perception shift. It's not just about the hard skills of using technology, but also about some of the soft skills that go, that, you know, have to do with how we connect and interact over the web. You know, the web has made a conversation between people on opposite ends of the earth, you know, instantaneous. And it's also, you know, we as consumers have more power over the things that are produced for us. Like, you know, right now you can go on Twitter and you can tweet at a particular company and say, hey, I really like your tool, but... And you know, give mm-hmm. real feedback that can be worked in. And you know, at Mozilla, we try really hard to make sure that we're paying attention to that feedback that people are giving us, and find ways to open that conversation up so that we can make it easier for people. Now, for people who don't, you know, who are uncomfortable with things that break, it's really about helping them understand that, you know, software is not magic. It's built by people, and people make mistakes. And the only way that we can actually improve things is if we know where the mistakes are. And so, you know, when a teacher uses popcorn, for example, and they run into something funny that happens, if they tell us about it, you know, then we can look into it and try to improve it and fix the bug or whatever's going on. But if they don't, then, you know, we might not run into that same mistake. So it's really about... You know, open source software is about a conversation between people who are trying to use the software and people who are trying to build it. And, you know, sort of messing up the lines between those two groups. You know, we have lots of people that contribute to Firefox or contribute to other tools that Mozilla makes who are also using the tools, you know, so they kind of have the best of both worlds. And we encourage people to get involved in that way.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it makes complete sense, especially in the ICT field. But when I was teaching music, for instance, if anything went wrong with my plan, I'd be floundering. That's the sort of picture I've got in my head. I was okay if I was teaching, you know, if I was teaching ICT, and it's quite a complicated, especially I think as a primary school teacher, when you're maybe teaching some things that are well outside your skill set, that. You know, that I think that you need to have at least a small set of very solid things that people can do and pick mm-hmm. up. And I really think that the tools that you've got, the way I've seen them evolve, you're getting very close to that with some of the thimble things, that you could mm-hmm. have a very simple thimble template that would just work, you know, as long as the school network held up, etc.,
right.
usual stuff. But you know, you could do that, and I'm wondering if that's a way to sort of start getting those in, is have maybe templates that would fit, very simple templates that would fit in with particular ideas we're teaching, mm-hmm. That might have nothing to do with the web. So, you know, if we're teaching, you could use the personality one if you were doing some personal and social development, or you could make a page for a historical figure. And mm-hmm. I wonder if there's, you've obviously built up a huge catalogue of, I don't know, how do you call them, templates for Thimble?
At this point, we're just calling them makes.
Bakes, yeah. So
yeah, makes.
The bakes for Thimble, the sort of pre-things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's maybe getting a set of those that would suit different people, filtered mm-hmm. out for those people, and that's maybe something that I don't know if the community or maybe even the ET people could help with at some point.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because the next 3 weeks of Teach the Web, we're actually going to be using what we're calling hackable kits.
Mm-hmm.
So we've put together a series of templates that are specifically for the mentor community to sort of help them think through how they might build teaching guides using Thimble. And so what we're going to do in Teach the Web is we're going to get into those Thimble templates and sort of, you know, see what people think. So the hackable kits are prototypes. We don't know if they're ready for prime time or not, but we're going to put them in a prime time situation and sort of see what happens. And I think you're right. I think that, you know, if we can get educators and technologists alike to sort of level up and just have even a basic level understanding of HTML and CSS, I mean, it's limitless what you can build with that. And so the second, you know, the next 3 weeks of Teach the Web are really going to be about that, about how limitless it is and how, you know, no matter what it is that you care about, if you're, you know, a biology teacher, the web can help you build, you know, interesting and engaging projects for your learners. So we're going to do that, and we're going to see what happens. And you know, we might come back to the drawing board, but I think that it's probably more likely that people get really engaged in creating their own things using Thimble. And you know, as you use Thimble, you're leveling up your skills as well. So it's not just about, you know, creating things that your learners can engage in, but also, you know, figuring out how, you know, what are the little pieces that, you know, make your job easier and make your creations on the web, you know, more beautiful or more interesting or more awesome.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to joining in with that as much as I can, because it's been, say, really good fun. This week's I'll say task, it's not a task, this week's focus is on openness.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said at the start of the show, that a friend in the community or in the MOOC said to me, oh, you should be talking about what we do here because this is open. It's an open podcast, and I wonder, I'd be interested from your point of view, you've maybe covered some of the benefits of working openly
mm-hmm.
when you've been talking, but if you were having to convince, not necessarily about technology, but openness in general, why is it better to work in the open rather than in the closed? What are the sort of benefits from that?
Wow.
Sorry.
I'm just thinking about how, you know, I'm an idealist, so when I think about that question, it can go very deep for me. I think that the main thing about, you know, working in an open space is, you know, being willing to hear what other people think and to learn from other people. I think that, you know, when you have a conversation and when you allow people into your thought process, And people can surprise you. They can give you a perspective that you hadn't thought of. And I think that that makes your work better. I think that we used to get very attached to the idea that something had to be finished and perfect before the rest of the world should interact with it. But I think that openness is about letting people in at the beginning of your thought process, not at the end. And then, you know, allowing their perceptions and their ideas to influence what it is that you make and do. So it used to be, you know, we used to think that if we waited until the end, then we would impress people with how much work we put in. But then the thing is that if you wait until the end, then people either like it or they hate it. And if they hate it, you know, what do? Yeah. Like, you go back to the beginning and start all over and hope that you get it right the second time. You know, so I think that working in the open is really beneficial because it pushes you to be better, you know, throughout the process of creation, as opposed to, you know, at the very end, realizing that people don't like that piece of art you made or whatever. And I mean, it is a very philosophical conversation, openness, you know, because sometimes people want to, they want to create without the influence of others. They want to push themselves and see how far they can go. But I think that working open just leads to more innovation, really, because I think that the more voices that you have in something, then the easier it is to see where, you know, your process might be falling down or where your thoughts, you know, might need the input from somebody else.
Yeah, I also think that it's more fun.
Yeah, fun is definitely part of openness too. Yeah. I don't know. Last week when we were talking about connected learning in practice, we were remixing other people's work. Mm-hmm. So the Make project was to find somebody else's introduction make that they had made and then remix it. And, you know, remixing is, I sort of look at remixing as a compliment. It's like you see something and if you want to remix it, then maybe that means that you've engaged with that something at a level that's beyond mere consumption. Like if you take that step to say, this is so awesome, I'm going to remix it so that it's even more awesome. It's really a compliment to the person that made it. And if you take something and say, this really upsets me and I you know, this pisses me off, I'm going to remix it so everybody knows why. Mm-hmm. You're sort of making, you know, you're making a critical sort of a I would say a criticism on whatever it is that you're commenting on. And I think that that opens the door for a deeper level of conversation around, you know, the theme of whatever it is you're remixing.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the sort of two strands of the MOOC that I've been interested in. And one of them is to use something like the Hackasaurus, where you can take something that, as I say, you maybe disapprove of or you want to contrast, and you change it to something else. One of the ones I did last week was I took the TED web page and changed it into the ET MOOC web page. And the idea is there, okay, compare prices and lots of other things. So what you've got is a very playful tool which can possibly be very political and possibly be very moral. Would that be fair to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. We have these conversations every Wednesday to various people, and everybody I've talked to who's enthusiastic about something in education, it comes down to morality at some point. And just getting the opinion that what you're doing in Mozilla you would see as a having a strong moral purpose, yeah?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, we need to, as a society and, you know, as a very large group of people, we need to figure out how to have empathy, you know, and how to support the people around us. And you know, when it comes to remixing, I've heard the argument, especially you know from educators that are not very active in the digital space, you know, and they're thinking about you know copyright in terms of plagiarism, and mm-hmm. you know, they're thinking about how do they teach their kids that it's not okay to steal ideas, mm-hmm. And I think that those are valid thoughts, and I think that it's important for people to understand what the difference is between, you know, a good steal and a bad steal. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's about helping people understand that when they accredit their sources, and when they, you know, have something valuable that they're using Remix to express, then that really is a good way to, you know, sort of give credit to the author of the original piece, and it's a good way to create a conversation. So, you know, in terms of morality, like, I don't think that the morals change because, you know, now we're starting to become a remix culture, and you know, people on the web are remixing. It's not that we're saying it's now okay to plagiarize because it's easy to remix. You know, we're very much conscious of the fact that we do get ideas from other places. And so part of when you're talking about the open ethos, and when you're talking about Remix, and when you're talking about, you know, what it means to participate in this space, part of the thing that's important to teach and important to do is to, you know, talk about how you accredit the work that you're looking at, and how do you give, you know, how do you give the author mm-hmm. an opportunity to take part in the conversation that you are creating by remixing their work?
Yeah, and I suppose if you look at all of our culture, it's always been remixed. You know, every painter is influenced by his peers, his predecessors, every writer learns by copying and changing and, you know, and playing yes. with the text.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, we as human beings, like, you know, we've been around for what, 150 to 200,000 years in our current form. Like, I mean, it's kind of silly to think that the things that we do today are not remixes of other things, you know? Like, I mean, we're constantly iterating on ideas of the past. Mm. Like, it's other people's perceptions that influence, you know, what we are and what we do. If we grew up in a place where we had no outside influence, then maybe that wouldn't be the case. But we don't grow up in that place. We all live together, and you know, human beings are social animals. We influence each other, and that's okay. It's okay to be influenced and have ideas that are based on somebody else's ideas. It's, you know, it's part of being human. So I think that we should encourage people to really explore and play with what that means.
Yeah, definitely. And just we're taking quite a lot of your time up, Laura. Just before you finish, the MOOC's still open. The teacher mm-hmm. the MOOC's still open. I saw today people were still being invited in with open arms, who had just caught on to it, so people can still join in. When I publish a podcast, we'll put the URLs to the various chunks of the MOOC up. So I'd really just like to say thanks very much for coming on and having a chat to yourself and to Chris, who was here earlier. It's been just fascinating to talk to you.
Thanks very much for having us.
Something quite wonderful going in the MOOC. It's interesting to watch it. You eat your own dog food as you iterate on the course, as people join in. And you've, I think, made a really good space for people to learn in, which a lot of us in education could learn a lot from. So thank you.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
Listening outside, next week we've got Pam Curry from Perth and Kinross, a bit nearer to home. She's going to be talking about the work she did at Education on Glow TV and the Perth and Kinross Cloud site, and designing online learning spaces, which connects up very nicely to this week's. Later on in June, I think, we've got Katie Barriman, who's going to be talking about zombies in plain English, which will be an interesting show, and Laura Compton from West Lothian talking about pupils and what they want from an online learning space. So hopefully people listen again. I'm certainly going to be jumping back into the Teach the Web MOOC for the next wee while. And just thanks again from Laura, and good night, folks.